Hello and welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, my very special guest is James Maskell. Author, speaker and entrepreneur James is passionate about healthcare transformation. He is the co-founder of the Functional Forum, the world's largest integrative medicine conference. He lectures internationally and has been featured on TEDMED, HuffPost Live, TEDx and more, and is a contributor to Huffington Post, Kevin MD, The Doctor Blog and MindBody Green. He also serves on the faculty of George Washington University's Metabolic Medicine Institute. In this interview, James discusses the importance of disrupting the current state of medicine and accelerating its future. He describes his goal to empower clinicians to transition to a functional medicine model and to become leaders and change agents towards healthcare that is both preventative and sustainable. We also talk about the importance of community and its critical role in avoiding chronic illness. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where my scientific director, Megan Hall, answers questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, as well as listen to all the replays covering everything from eye floaters to anorexia. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's interview with James Maskell. Well, James, thank you so much for joining me this morning. How are you doing?
Great to be here with you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
How has lockdown been treating you over the last few months?
You know, I hate to say it, but it's been great. My first business really took off about 6 months after my daughter was born in 2013-14. And pretty much since then, a sort of a wave of opportunity opened up and I've had to travel a lot. And some of it's been really exciting and some of it's kind of been boring. And, you know, for the first time, I'm not expected to be anywhere, which has been great. So I've just been, you know, with my family and relaxing. Obviously, I feel super fortunate to be in a position where it hasn't really affected me sort of financially. And obviously, heart goes out to, you know, to all the people that it has. I do have some issues in that my mother lives in England, which is currently on lockdown and I haven't been able to visit. My dad lives in South Africa, which has had the harshest lockdown in the world and I haven't been able to visit. And they've been sort of in their 80s alone in their sort of 500 square feet apartments. So, you know, we're spending a lot of time on WhatsApp and trying to keep everything going. But here it's been a great time.
Pretend you just met me on a bus and you don't know anything about me. How would you describe yourself? Who are you?
I'm an entrepreneur. I'm passionate about healthcare transformation. I'm a father. I'm a cricketer. I'm a Scrabble player. And yeah, just someone who's been passionately involved for the last 15 years in trying to create a healthcare system that actually gets people well and keeps people well.
And tell me about your time living in a commune in Colorado.
I kind of outed myself in my latest book, The Community Cure. I was born in a commune in Colorado. The commune had branches in England and South Africa where I grew up. So I don't have the American accent because I was just born there. And, you know, that community was very much involved in, you know, natural medicine. They had like an energy medicine technique that they would teach everyone there called attunement. I was just in this community until I was 11, living in the different communities in England and South Africa, visiting America every summer. And I didn't really realize that that was sort of abnormal until I got to school and realized no one knew what all the things that I was talking about. No one knew what a chiropractor was. No one knew what homeopathy was. You know, certainly like I knew a ton of adults that weren't my parents and had interacted with a lot of them. And I didn't really realize any of that was abnormal until I got to school. I remember when I was 13, sort of kind of venturing something about that in religious studies and basically being bullied for about 5 years afterwards and realizing like this was not a cool thing to talk about. And I didn't really talk about it for a long time. And I had a meeting when I was about 32 and I was in New York and I was sitting in Deepak Home Base, which is Deepak Chopra's like event center, this beautiful place called ABC Home. And I was just about to have a meeting with the woman who organizes the content. And I was like, maybe I'm just going to like be honest and tell her about my story. And in that meantime, community went from being weird to being cool. And suddenly, like, I just realized, like, oh, wow, this was actually kind of a cool advantage. And so I kind of still resisted telling the story. But in the last book, I came out because the whole book was about, you know, community models of medicine.
Uh-huh. I've just finished reading The Community Cure, Transforming Health Outcomes Together. It's fantastic. I'd recommend anyone listening to this read it. Was it not another type of commune when you moved into boarding school? Was that not a different
Yeah, the weirdest commune you've ever met. I mean, certainly like the difference between like the spiritual community with everyone like caring each other and then like, you know, the years 13 to 15, I think are rough for everyone around the world. But imagine you're like locked away with the crazy inmates and, you know, there's no real respite for it. My dad had just moved to the other side of the world. Like you didn't see your parents that much. And so it was just like a pretty intense experience of just like boys working out their like hormonal shifts together and bullying and aggression and just like crazy things that only happen when you're between the ages of 13 and 16. So yeah, it was a different kind of a community. I would say that was kind of mainly a disempowering community. And I think that's one of the reasons why people have a problem with communities. If everyone looks at the first communities they were involved with, like their family, there's obviously sometimes dysfunction in that setting. Then you have the high school locker room, dysfunction all abounds there. And then, you know, your first job, right? These are people's first sort of experiences of community. And a lot of times they're not just disempowering, but, you know, really traumatizing. And so the idea of being in a community doesn't sound too appealing, but ultimately, you know, for many reasons, it's definitely the future. And so part of what the heavy lift that we're going to have to do in the next little while is to give people sort of a glimpse and a taste of what it's like to be in a mutually empowering community.
Mm-hmm. I did an interview with Peter Gray. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Peter Gray. He's a psychologist. He has a book, Free to Learn. And he talks about the importance of age mixed learning. And, you know, I think about that with the boarding school. Presumably your age match, all the boys are the same age. So there's not a positive role model anywhere in sight, right? It's like the emotional blind leading the emotional blind.
Yeah, definitely. Not just blind, like fully on dysfunctional.
I was trying to be polite. So was there nothing from that early life living in a commune that you wanted to replicate in your adult family life?
I mean, definitely 100%. So I went to university, that was better. And I really enjoyed that process. And I was with like, I got to choose my friends, basically. So, you know, that was a great step. Then I started working in the investment bank. So I just got the best job out of university. I was still in the sort of like phase where I thought my parents were crazy and, you know, smart people go and work on trading floors and make lots of money. I took that first job and I was having a great time in London. But I kind of realized like, this was a dysfunctional situation. Like the guys who were meant to be my mentors, I actually had this incredible thing happen where my mentor's like leaving party while I was working at the trading floor was there and he got hammered at his leaving party. And at the end of it kind of burst out into tears. And was like, whatever you do, don't do this. Like I've sat here for 30 years and I've wasted my life. Don't do the same thing. So I was like, all right, mentor, thank you. So that was one thing. But also I just saw that like, you know, normal life was not really that functional. Like I was living in London. You have a lot of people like raging for the weekend. There's this massive discongruence between who they are at work and who they are out of work. And I just realized like I had witnessed the fact that I had witnessed congruent people. Like I had witnessed people that were getting on with their life, doing what they cared about every day and were sort of matching their passion for what they want to see happen in the world with their work and not just having to be like weekend warriors, either, you know, partying or being like political activists on the weekend and evenings, you know, outside of their job. And so because I'd grown up with a different health system and because I'd recognized from my like education, which I did economics at university, realized, you know, there was this huge fiscal cliff that most developed economies in the world were going to fall off, which was this exponentially rising increase in healthcare costs that was going on in the US. US was like the poster child of like the most embarrassing situation of how quickly costs were going up and life expectancy starting to tail off and even go down. But in the UK, the same thing. And they've got single payer, which is sort of touted as the way that we're going to solve it in America. And their costs were going up exponentially too.
Right.
And I knew that there was a different way of doing healthcare. And I knew that like I'd grown up with people who were like pretty healthy and weren't in hospital and weren't having dialysis and weren't on autoimmune suppressive drugs, what I started to realize is that the uniqueness of my upbringing could be a positive and not just a negative. And as soon as I realized that, I just sort of had to go on a different path.
And I understand that your goal now is to make functional medicine the standard of care. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So look, the first thing that I came across when I came to America was I worked in a clinic and I saw chronic disease being reversed, right? Not just people getting off medication, but people visibly changing, right? Over 6 months, I worked in this clinic in Georgia and I saw people reverse chronic illness. So I was like, I don't think people know that this is possible. This is 2005. So it was not just like, this was not something that anyone really knew about, but I had seen it with my own eyes. Then I took the next 7 years to really learn everything about the industry. I took a job in sales. I was selling to doctors, doing all different names of what's essentially the same thing: functional medicine, integrated medicine, naturopathic medicine. Like, there's all these names for it, and there's subtle differentiation between the names, but ultimately they have things in common. And the thing that they have in common is that the goal is self-efficacy. The goal is getting the patient to a point where they don't need medicine anymore, where they understand how their body works and they're doing all the healthy behaviors to stay healthy. And two, you're getting to the root cause. So you're not just like suppressing symptoms with drugs. You're really trying to understand what's causing the baseline of the dysfunction. And, you know, as I went through that journey, I realized that unlike all of those other names, functional medicine had a repeatable operating system where everyone did it the same. And one of the things I learned from those 7 years of being in sales was that everyone kind of had their own, you know, language for what this was. And as long as everyone was speaking different languages, you could never really get like a cohesive movement to actually change things over. So the first thing I realized was like, okay, functional medicine has to be a lot more popular than it is now. If I take a step back, you know, what I did in the last decade was to help doctors make the switch to functional medicine. That's what my business was about. I started a show called The Functional Forum. It started as a meetup in New York for functional medicine doctors. We wanted to make functional medicine like aspirational and sexy so that doctors would like take the training and then start to build a practice actually reversing chronic disease with people. So that was part one. This decade is really about the large scale adoption of functional medicine and how that grows from being like a nationwide network of doctors that we have now to really building the systems that could bring this kind of healthcare to, you know, a million people, a billion people eventually. And that's what I'm like really involved in today.
Tell me about the problems you saw scaling functional medicine.
Anyone who's ever experienced functional medicine and knows anything about it can see straight away that it's the most inefficient delivery system of medicine ever, right? So what's the first thing you do in a functional medicine interaction? You have a 2-hour appointment with the most expensive provider, right? So straight away, that doesn't work in the insurance game because there's no codes for a 2-hour appointment. So that's the first thing, is like super inefficient. Second, it takes ages, like years, for doctors to get trained in how to be a functional medicine doctor. So it's hard to like scale up. Three, when you try and do it in a hospital setting, it's not profitable. So a lot of these centers went out of business because, you know, the maths guy at the clinic would be like, yeah, well, you know, the philanthropy money's run out and we can make a lot more money per square foot, you know, giving people heart stents than teaching people not to need a heart stent. And so, right, you know, that's out. And then the fourth thing is, if we're going to build a whole medical system based on behavior change, it's not really working that well. And we're definitely not following the best practices of how we know to help people change behavior. So there's pretty four glaring reasons why this cannot work in its current form.
Yeah, it seems to me that a lot of functional medicine providers end up doing something on the side to pay the bills, right? Like, be it, I don't know, IV, vitamins and something else, or maybe just conventional pain medicine or something. And that's what pays the bills. And then you do your altruistic stuff on a Friday, right? Like, you see a few functional medicine patients on a Friday. Do you recognize that? Do you think that's common?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, most doctors, they have a hunch that they're not like really helping patients to get healthy because none of the things that they're doing actually facilitate more health, right? Typically, right? Drugs, you know, if you gave the same drugs that you're giving to these unhealthy people to healthy people, it wouldn't get them healthier. It would make them sick over time. So they kind of know that, but they don't really know that there's another way. Most of the doctors that kind of get pushed in this direction is because of either something with them or someone they love, like a family member or a kid, particularly, who gets sick and then they they have to look outside of their toolbox, and then they feel this like moral obligation to practice a new type of medicine. And when they feel that moral obligation, then they're like, oh, I really want to like do this, but they can't really work out how to pay the bills. And that was kind of one of the reasons why we pivoted what we were doing, you know, away from just being a media channel towards being sort of like a practice development company, because we had worked out a kind of a unique way for doctors to kind of cross that threshold, which is this idea of a micro practice, which is essentially running a practice off a laptop with almost no overhead, so that you could even consider sort of making this shift across. And we've helped a lot of doctors to, yeah, start their functional medicine practice on a Friday, build it up, get confidence, start getting new patients in, and then start to renegotiate their contracts with whatever job they have, so that eventually as the traction builds, they can sort of move across without, you know, losing income. But it's not easy, and it requires you, you know, if anything, in medicine, we're seeing most doctors selling their practices to hospitals and just becoming employees, because all of the business of medicine is annoying and hard. And so we're kind of asking doctors to go back in the other direction. But the good news is, when they do, the success stories are incredible. And all of the our idea with the Functional Forum is, let's put these like aspirational doctors who now have a great life in front of other doctors and say, hey, you could be reversing chronic illness and working 2 days a week if you just follow this plan. And, you know, that was pretty successful at getting a couple thousand more doctors moving towards functional medicine. And now we're at a point where there's kind of a functional medicine doctor in every town.
Do you ever find yourself talking doctors off the ledge? The ones I've met, they're typically very conservative. And part of what drives that conservatism is the student debt that they've accumulated to get to where they are. You know, like the idea of doing marketing to get patients terrifies them because they've got this debt hanging over them.
Yeah, I mean, I think, isn't that the same with everyone in society? It's just like even more acute with doctors. But yeah, I mean, I see that, and taking a risk is not that easy. But, you know, what I also see now is doctors kind of coming through medical school on a trajectory to practice this type of medicine, where they kind of, you know, went through medical school kind of biting their tongue and come out the other side ready to do it, because they realize, like, if you get it right and have the right energy, you can set your own rules and you can really do very well. You know, we're in the sort of in-between time.
Talk about the loneliness problem. I think this is interesting because it's possibly the most important problem that you could ever solve for a client or patient. And it's also the hardest problem you could ever solve for a client or patient. And it also, the solution might feed into this problem of scaling functional medicine. So can you talk about the problem of loneliness?
Yeah. So 2015, I'm sitting in the back of the IFM annual conference, and it's all on genetics. And the topic is human social genomics. And it's this guy from the UCLA stress lab called George Slavich is giving the talk. And he basically shows on his slides that the most critical root cause from their research of what is driving chronic disease is not smoking, it's not alcohol, it's not nutrition, it's not exercise, it's loneliness. It's social stress driven by loneliness. And I'm sitting next to Dr. Shilpa Saxena, who's a friend, who was one of the first people to work out this group visit model. And we looked at each other and we're like, damn, like if we're the root cause doctors, you know, we're all kind of missing a pretty significant root cause here. That started me, like I'd just been introduced to the group visit a couple years ago, but I started to realize like, okay, introducing patients to each other, creating new friendships and empowering communities of people needs to be a priority for doctors, because as long as people are still being served one-on-one and there's no change in their like social situation, nothing's going to change. And I guess the way that I started to, as I started to learn the nomenclature, I started to realize like all chronic disease is biopsychosocial in nature, right? There are biological factors, there are psychological factors, and there are social factors that lead to mental illness and chronic illness. When you understand it like that, it's so obvious that we can't reverse biopsychosocial conditions with a biological input, like aka a drug. And so as soon as I realized that, I was like, look, we need to solve for this. And that was really the beginning of looking to really understand, how is that even solvable? Is there anyone solving it? What would it look like to solve that? And that's sort of what led, you know, a couple of years later to really, first of all, to really own the fact that community was going to have to make its way into medicine in some significant way, to then own the fact that like this is my jam, right? This is what I was, more than even functional medicine. Yes, we all took the weird supplements growing up, and that was a part of what I was born into. But ultimately, I was born into this commune, and this was really like mine to own. And so over the next few years, really started to feature more and more content built on community. At the same time, these communities of doctors doing functional medicine were exploding all across the country and across the world. So we had 400 like little meetups of doctors getting together once a month to, learn from each other and build like positive feedback loops, locally. And then in 2018, I did this bus tour around the country where we went and did like 26 live events over 4 months. And as part of that tour, I got to go and visit the Cleveland Clinic Center for Functional Medicine, which was sort of like the first, major medical institution that was taking on functional medicine. And what I saw there led me to really see how you could solve for loneliness and how you could rebuild community in a medical setting and infuse it with functional medicine. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, okay, this is it. Like the right model, the right operating system of care, and being done by a major medical institution with the right data. And I was just like, okay, this is the way it's going to roll out. And so for the last 2 years, I've just been passionately involved in like really trying to work out what are all the ways that people are doing it? What can we learn from each other? And I put that all into that book, but the learning still continues to this day.
I've just been revisiting John T. Cacioppo's famous book, Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. And he has a fantastic idea that he presents there. If you asked a zookeeper to create a proper enclosure for the species Homo sapiens, she would list at the top of her concerns obligatory gregarious, meaning that you do not house a member of the human family in isolation any more than you house a member of the penguin species on hot desert sand. It simply makes no sense to put a creature in that environment that stretches the genetic leash quite that far. And yet I do a quick Google search to see how many people in the US are living alone now, and it's 34.75 million people living alone in the US. That seems nuts to me.
It is nuts. And, obviously this year has sort of cranked it all up, because now, isolation is the plan. And so, so we're in it deeper than we've been, and it's even more pressing and telling that like this is the only reasonable, solution moving forward.
Something I wonder about is where the hell did this come from in the first place? This idea of dividing our society into nuclear families, monogamous nuclear families, right? The reason I think about this is because, MBT, we're always thinking about the process that got us to where we are now and how the intervention might potentially make things worse. So I think that, Dan Lieberman has been really good coining the term disevolution and environmental mismatch, right? So as an example, think about the problem of there not being enough room in your jaw for all of your wisdom teeth, right? So maybe the problem is caused by insufficient, chewy, hard, fibrous foods consumed as a young child, and that provides insufficient stimulation to the jaw that then leads to a jaw that's too small, and then you have to hire an orthodontic surgeon to cut the teeth outright. So the problem is the environmental mismatch, right? The mismatch between the inputs your genes were expecting from food and what actually happened. But then he coins this term disevolution. The orthodontic surgeon may actually make the problem worse, right? By intervening and cutting the teeth. That's sure, you solve the problem in the short term, but you're creating this vicious cycle that allows us to continue eating the mushy foods. And so perpetuates the problem and possibly makes it worse. And so I wonder, what the hell happened here with Western society? And is there a potential for the intervention, the group program, to make it worse? Have you thought about this at all?
I have thought about how we got there. I mean, certainly one of the things I talked about in my book was technology. Now, whether that technology was the car, right? And that's in the last 100 years, but now people can live in, they don't have to live in close proximity. They can move to the suburbs and have their own single family home, or whether that technology is Walmart and, strip malls. So now you don't have relationships with any of the people that you buy things from. And then it gets to like Uber and Amazon, where you're literally being served by like strangers and you've never connected, you know, there's no connection. So I sort of put it on technology for sort of like this fraying of society. But I think if you went even further back, you know, you could look at, you know, sort of like the technology that took us away from living in clusters of 100 to 150 people. You know, so I think you could blame technology. I'm sure the church has something to do it because they were, you know, up to no good for a few thousand years. So I would put something on them. But whether it could make it worse, like, I guess part of the learning that got me here was this understanding of externalities, right? What are these external costs that are borne on society by whatever intervention? And I feel like most of the things you're talking about are because people don't really understand things in a holistic way. They think about problem solution, and then there are like the knock-on effects of executing the solution. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of like, in that understanding of externalities, what I really started to understand was really that, I mean, this is maybe getting a little bit too much into like economic theory, but my thesis in the last 15 years has been that over time, in an enclosed system, which is like the globe and the Earth, the externalities that are driven off the back of an interaction are actually much more valuable than the actual interaction itself. And the negative externalities play out over time. And that's why, for instance, like the first coal-powered power station in Beijing, you know, is a net benefit. But by the 100th one, you can't see your hand in front of your face because of all the pollution that's, you know, kicked up. And what I started to realize is like what we need to focus on are things that have proven positive externalities. And if you look at that through, like, let's say education is typically an obvious one where one person's education knocks onto another and causes positive ripple effects. But if we look at health, you know, ultimately what's being engaged in the group is really like these positive externalities where one person's healing and one person's learning is actually providing a ton of value to everyone in the group. And that's the main, like, if I had to take a step back and say, what is the headline from the book, is that someone who you meet who has gone through a health transformation and then can kind of talk you through what they did and how they did it is actually the most important sort of health professional in the system. The patient is the most important person, and stepping into patient-centered care is what we're all about. But if we're stepping into patient-centered care, it means the patient actually has to do stuff. Like, they have to participate in their health. And what I came to learn, you know, through the book and through this understanding is that this peer-to-peer dynamic and this peer-to-peer delivery of value is actually the strongest force that we have in healthcare to enact change. And not only that, it's like a completely unlimited, and we're using it to 0% of its potential. And so really what this group model and the community cure is all about is really taking advantage of that peer-to-peer dynamic and trying to unleash that force, because there's an unlimited amount of it and we're just not using it to anywhere near its potential.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I've just started reading The Weirdest People in the World. And that's a book by Joseph Henrich. And weird is actually an acronym. It's Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. And these people, like you and me, the US, the UK, we are not like the rest of the world. And I worry a bit that you're sort of swimming up a cultural stream. And I think that you nailed it when you said the church was involved, because in the early Middle Ages, a series of taboos on cousin marriage, a campaign against polygamous marriage, and new inheritance customs is where all this like nuclear family business came from. And that was the beginning of the atomization and the individualistic culture. And I think you're right. You know, Joseph Henrich writes about that in the book, that we are obligate cultural learners. And to give you an example, you know, you could throw me out into the wild and I would have no clue how to hunt and gather, even though that's what humans have been doing for millions of years. And the reason is I never had the opportunity to learn that from anyone else. And, you know, that's what's happened to us. Now we've been divided up, atomized, and nobody really knows how to look after themselves anymore, right? There's not a positive role model anywhere in sight. And so, yeah, functional medicine providers doing one-on-one calls, teaching one people at a time, it's just not going to work. You're going to need something that scales much better than that.
Yeah, Bear Grylls on TV.
Do you know what? That's really funny. We have just been watching Bear Grylls. I was not familiar with him really at all. I think I've been sleeping under a rock for the last two decades. But my seven-year-old daughter, of course, has fallen instantly in love with Bear Grylls. She also likes Bruce Parry as our other favourite explorer. I think possibly ex-military as well, actually, I think.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, look, I mean, certainly we need those role models. But the good news is, like, what functional medicine already has is enough awesome role models. Think of everyone who signed up to be a health coach. What is a health coach, right? A health coach is not a health professional, really. They're not licensed to do anything by their state, but they're kind of a health professional in that they can, you know, they're good at coaching and helping you do healthy behaviors. What they almost all have in common is that they came through some sort of catastrophic illness and came out the other side and now want to teach everyone what they learned. One of the things that made me realize, okay, functional medicine is where it's at, is because not only are there like thousands, maybe 100,000 providers trained in functional medicine, this like operating system and common language, but there's now tens of thousands of coaches and they're all ready to go. If you could just find a way to like get them involved, they're ready to mentor the shit out of everyone. And so it's just about getting everyone in the right seats, in the right, you know, seats on the bus. And so, you know, for a long time, you know, my business partner was a health coach who had worked in a functional medicine office. And, you know, he really saw the power of, you know, the doctor coming up with the plan and then the health coach in a very short period of time, the doctor coming up with the plan and then the health coach helping people to execute the plan. And that was the first sort of thing. And we talked about that for years on the functional forum. And then when I started seeing the groups, like most health coaches were pretty, for doctors, it's actually hard for them to become group leaders because what you need to be a group leader is actually kind of the opposite of what you need to be a doctor. Like doctors have been valued forever in like knowing everything. But when I saw this guy, Dr. Jeffrey Geller, who's like the godfather of the integrated group visit, I saw him do his thing once and it was important for him not to know the answer. Right? It was important for him to get the other people in the group to share the answer. Like he could moderate it, but as long as he had the answers, they were dependent on him. And what he was masterful at was really getting people to solve each other's problems. And this is why, if we look at healthcare today, one of the things that is being the biggest problem that everyone's starting to realize is that the majority of what makes up people's health are these social determinants of health. And for most people in America, it's kind of a mess. Like if you have two jobs, three kids and no car, you're definitely not starting a new detox regimen or taking a yoga class because you're not empowered to make your own decisions. We can't change the trajectory of healthcare and the cost of healthcare without getting poor people healthy, right? Mm-hmm. That's where all the cost is coming from. And we need to really focus in on like everyone, not just the richest 10% who can afford functional medicine. And what I saw Dr. Geller do and what I've seen from him is that if done right, these empowerment focused group visit models, they're literally getting people in a group together and in a dynamic way, helping them solve each other's social determinants of health. Because, you know, you don't really need everyone to go home and make their own smoothie if one person can make 10 times as much and share it out. You know, and that's the efficiency of the group system is just all the way through. And ultimately, like, that's why the future has to be delivered in that way.
So how best to capitalize on all these health coaches? I can certainly relate to that. And it's been the same story for many of our clients here at MBT is, you know, as you go through the program, you've got one eye on a career change. It's just not clear exactly how you make that career change and when you make it as well. You know, there's a tendency for people to think that they have to be perfect before they can start. And I would argue against that. Like the moment you're perfect, of course, you'll never get there. But if, let's suppose you did get there, then all of a sudden you'd stop being able to relate to people who are going through the same process, you know. But my question for you is like, how best to make that career change? How do you think these budding health coaches should go about
it? Well, I think you could like do it on the side, you know, at the beginning while you're learning and do the training on the evenings and weekends because it's typically not that rigorous. We're talking about a year or two. I mean, ultimately, what's going to need to change the paradigm is structures to be built that work out how to get all these people to have jobs doing health coaching. You know, thus far, you come out of health coaching school and it's like, okay, go get them, build a business. And it's like, it's not easy. Like people don't even know, most people don't even know what a health coach is. So, you know, and the health coaching programs tend to like overpromise the like riches on the other side of the $5,000 investment that you make. And so, you know, ultimately we've had a lot of people that have come through this process, but have not found a job or have not found an opportunity to live that. And so, you know, that's part of the work, but I see that the group model is sort of where this is all going because the coaches love it. the patients love the coaches because they're way more relatable to the doctor. I mean, one of the things that I've heard time and time again, Chris, and we've heard this in even some of the experiments that we've been doing, is people basically saying that in the group, they feel confident to share things that they would never tell their doctor. Like straight away, we have a huge problem is that people lie to their doctor. They don't want to be vulnerable in front of their doctor in some cases, because there's just like this, you know, power dynamic that's built into medicine because of where it came from that isn't creating an opportunity for truthful communion, if you want to call it whatever you want to call it. And in the groups, you know, just a little bit of vulnerability from someone, starting with the coach, leads to this like vulnerability and honesty container that allows people to really get real about where they are and have real dialogue. And that's what's going to be needed at scale to turn the health of the country around. Like, there's no other way, as far as I see it. There's not enough services or drugs. Like, no sort of outward intervention can solve the problem. And so we just need a scaled up solution to actually solve it, you know, to create that opportunity for everyone. And what's so exciting about this group model is that, you know, all the things that I said initially were things that held back functional medicine, when you deliver it in a group, it's the opposite. So where it was once unaffordable, now it can be done on insurance, right? Where it was now unscalable, you can train these health coaches, you can give them a curriculum and they can get going in a short amount of time. And they can still have the doctors ready to treat people if they need to either get off medication or if they have something come up that's not in the coach's scope, you know, they can still step in because the coach is really just there fulfilling the support. And most importantly, we're building a model based on the behavior change system that we know works. So, you know, just to give you some context on that, in 1940 in America, if you went to like the AMA convention, they would tell you medical orthodoxy at that time was that alcoholism was incurable, right? Mm-hmm. So you could, if you were an alcoholic, there was no way back. There was nothing you could give. Why was that the case? It's because they were delivering medicine to those people, drugs and doctors. And there's still no drugs and doctors that can reverse alcoholism. What alcoholics need to become not alcoholics anymore is accountability, support, and mentorship. And ultimately, like learning from Alcoholics Anonymous, all we have to do is build Alcoholics Anonymous for type 2 diabetes, heart disease, autoimmune disease, mental health. And that's what we're doing. And that's what is being talked about in the book and showcase that for every kind of niche of medicine, for every kind of like silo, cardiology, pediatrics, whatever, there's now a really good example of this being done well. And not just with like, you know, all the way from preconception and birth outcomes with something like centering pregnancy, where just putting women in groups together reduces preterm birth by 35%, all the way up to Terry Walls consistently reversing MS using the Walls protocol delivered in a group where people are supported to go through that in the VA and everything in between. And so it's just like, okay, let's get with the program. I kind of thought at the beginning of the year that ultimately I'm doing kind of what I thought, slightly different because of COVID. But ultimately, you know, that's what I'm going to be involved with for the next 10 years is scaling this out.
I've just witnessed that firsthand, actually. You know, MBT's been going for about 7 years now. And we just did our first group program. And it's actually really Simon's group program. Dr. Simon Marshall, our performance psychologist, and his wife, Leslie Patterson, are hosting a group and we're learning to become more resilient mentally. And Simon kicked off that group with some, you know, why are you here? Why now? And there was just like a spark of vulnerability and then it just like burst into flames. And it was just absolutely blew me away. Like the things that people were saying to, I mean, otherwise a group of strangers, but like something has brought them together. And that was on Zoom, you know, like I could sort of imagine that happening if it was a real life in-person meetup, but this was on Zoom. Absolutely incredible. So powerful. And I just kind of regret not knowing about that sooner.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't really know about it. And look, groups have been done in conventional medicine for a while. There's been diabetes groups and whatever, but on the average, those things are like mutually disempowering, right? They're not really the empowerment focused machines that these like functional medicine groups are. And that's because a lot of it was just getting together to share like how horrible your life was. Whereas with functional medicine, there's like a curriculum that people can learn, right? They can really go deep. I mean, just setting SMART goals, right? Setting goals of where you want to get and like telling other people in the group, like, I want to get healthy because I want to be able to like kiss my grandkids when they turn 18 or see their graduation or whatever that is. Like that, just sharing that with a group of people. And then, you know, accountability. It's really like having someone who holds you accountable. There's no health accountability, and most people just need health accountability. They don't necessarily need doctors. They just need someone who's going to hold them accountable to their own goals that they came up with, and the group is perfect for that.
So imagine I'm a primary care doctor and I want to learn how to do this, you know. So what are the steps I'd need to take? We previously interviewed Dr. Julian Abel, who in the UK has been building compassionate communities. And I understand they have a program where they're teaching community connectors, but I don't know too much of the details. So what are the steps that I would need to take if I wanted to start a group program inside of my primary care practice or other practice?
It just really depends on what you wanted to do, but there's different ways of doing it depending on like your payment model and what you're looking to achieve. But ultimately, you know, there are great resources that have already been created. There's a whole load of like group visit toolkits that have, you know, the systems, because there are things that are sort of clumsy that you have to get right. So, you know, for instance, like if you have 18 people in a group, making sure that you're taking 18 sets of notes that are going to go into the record for the billing or whatever, like there's some cumbersome pieces of it there, but things like the group visit toolkits have been created to make it easy to like get over those kind of issues. I mean, ultimately you just need to decide like, what do patients want? And then create something that's going to be a fit for them. On the average, for people who are empowered, right? People who are in the top 70% of income earners in America, maybe the top 40%, depending on, you know, pre or post COVID. But for those people, typically like some sort of like structured program over a period of months is, or a period of weeks or months is a good way to like give them the information and start that process. You know, for Dr. Geller, working with the poorest people in a federally qualified healthcare center in Massachusetts, those groups never stopped, right? Those were, they started off as diabetes reversal groups, but in a year or so's time, like most people had made significant strides against their type 2 diabetes, and it became a weekly salsa dancing get together and then a gardening thing in the summer. Like it was very much just like a social club that had evolved from a type 2 diabetes group. So the most important thing is just to start. There's certainly a ton of resources in the book and, you know, through everything that I've been doing in the last 6 years to be able to take people where they want to go. And if you're listening and you're a primary care doctor, if you're any type of doctor and you, and this appeals to you, we could probably save you a lot of time, effort and money by just, you know, getting in touch with us and we can send you in the right direction.
Yeah, well, let me give you a specific example. Imagine I'm a primary care doctor working in a Medicare practice, right? So all of my patients, by definition, are older, and they all have a hemoglobin A1C of 10 or above. Like, it's that bad. And for all intents and purposes, you think you're just doing palliative care doctoring, right? Like, you think there's nothing can be done for these people. How do you go about talking to those patients to persuade is probably the wrong word, to help them find the intrinsic motivation to join a group and be reconnected to a community?
I mean, you have to just think what's in it for them, right? You know, ultimately, part of what medicine is really listening and empathizing and hearing what's going on. You know, in those compassionate communities in Froome in England, it starts with, if someone says that they're lonely, then this is like the plan, is to get them into one of these groups. So, you know, I think it's listening. And then it's like, for some people, it's going to be because they need a new community and they don't have like friends and they don't have people who can hold them accountable to these like healthy behaviors that they want to do. For some people, it's that they just, you know, haven't been able to maintain the healthy behaviors. I mean, that's the biggest thing that I see, is just the social isolation that occurs at any age when you can't participate in the super unhealthy norms of society. Like if you have an autoimmune disease and you are deathly allergic to gluten and you can't have pizza and beer night on Fridays, that can pretty much ruin your social life. So you have to find, either you have to find other ways to participate in that where you're like, your group of friends really cares, or you have to find another group of friends where they know that, you know, we're going to have to make some different choices and we're going to go to different restaurants and we're going to, you know, have different behaviors. But some of the things that have been really amazing to hear, there's this group actually called AIP.
Yeah, well, regular listeners will be very familiar with AIP, and that was my story as well. And I've actually interviewed Mickey Trescott.
Yeah, Mickey and Angie, so, dude. They've got the system where,
unbelievable.
Where people can show up, and they've got people like meeting and, you know, meeting in a commercial kitchen and cooking all their meals for a week, once a week, and getting all that done in a week and taking all of the sting out of the pain of making all your own food because, you know, you're doing it as a collaborative and, you know, you're sharing the bounty of making, I don't know, meatball and squash for, you know, for 20 people rather than one, and just sharing it out in your glass Tupperware. So all of these things are possible, and communities are really building around people with specific conditions. And I'm excited to see where that's going.
Talk about health sharing systems. I found this out the hard way, right? Like, you kind of quit your job in finance and your PPO insurance goes away. And then you look at, for me, it was Covered California, and $2,000 a month gets me a catastrophic health plan. You know, if I get in a car wreck and puncture a lung and spend 2 weeks in the intensive care unit, then maybe I won't go bankrupt. But that's about all I get for my $2,000 a month. And so I eventually found these health sharing ministries, which are an exemption from the Affordable Care Act, right? It's like, it's how they get away with it. And they're a fraction of the price. I think I pay $500 a month now for my entire family. And it's not something I really use. One of the things they were very good with is they pay for midwives, which my PPO would never do. So it's actually, you know, really come out ahead for me financially. But it seems like the health sharing ministry, or health sharing in general, seems like a critical part of your model. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I do talk about it in the last chapter. And I actually, in 2018, started the first non-denominational medical cost sharing thing in America. I can't actually use it now because I live in California and there's some laws there, but in 47 states, it's live. I came across it in the same way. You know, I was going to have a daughter in 2013. My mother-in-law was like, you got to have health insurance. And I hadn't had it before. And so, yeah, we got medical cost sharing then and never looked back. And yeah, you know, just comparing it, like, I had an awesome pediatrician that only took cash. So that was fine. I just pay him cash. I, you know, had a home birth with a midwife, and, you know, so it just made a lot of sense, and it's making sense for a lot of people. That's why it's got to over 1 million users in America. The key differential is there's not much difference in the model. But in health insurance, the mental construct is, I'm paying so much for this already, I might as well get my money's worth. And that's why once you hit your deductible, it's like an ATM. That's what I hear anyway. I've never had it, but I hear that from doctors and users and otherwise. Whereas, you know, in the medical cost sharing, one, you're sort of agreeing that you're going to live a healthy lifestyle. But two, you're sort of like a custodian of the mutual funds. And so you don't, you know, you treat it with respect. And it's just that, like, it's just even like the difference in the mental construct makes all the difference for, you know, how money goes out of the system and therefore what gets paid. And my vision actually for this, and we may end up doing this in India where there's 1.2 billion people without health insurance. My vision for this is kind of like the Christian ministries, but completely transparent, total transparency on a blockchain, and ultimately being able to get groups of people together to work together to minimize healthcare costs. Because through that kind of model, you can actually have it be self-policing, and you can have all the incentives line up for, you know, for people to do the right thing by the group. So I believe that cost sharing is a critical component, and it's just community applied to risk prevention. And what this group visit model is, community applied to, you know, chronic care delivery, and they work very well together.
As an economist, I'm sure you understand this, but part of the problem surely is that people don't know how much things cost at the point of care. And I would challenge you to do this, right? Like, I got in a bike wreck at the start of a bike race recently. And so I've got, you know, 4 stitches on my elbow. And so I can walk into the urgent care and say, how much to fix that? You know, and like, see if you can get an answer out of the person on the front desk. That, like, most places, they just won't give you an answer at all. And some will give you a ballpark. But yeah, I think that's part of the problem is that, you know, when you present your PPO cards, you've no idea how much anything costs. And so there's no incentive for you to shop around.
The scam is deep and very layered. And so we have to unwind it piece by piece.
Can you name any of the health sharing systems that you've been involved in? And you said that one was available in 47 states.
Yeah, so I started one called New Health, K-N-E-W, New Health. That's the one that is that we started. The one that I use is called Liberty Health Share, which is the one that I used before I started New Health. And now I have now because I live in California. And, you know, long story short, it was grandfathered in the same way that, you know, the whole thing was grandfathered in. So you don't have to pay the tax penalty in the state of California. but in 47 states, you can sign up for NeueHealth. And in the one that we created, there's a lot of tech stuff in there, and there's a lot more, like, it's easier to submit bills. It's not being run by, like, Mennonites in Ohio. It's actually being run by a really well-organized company. And so, you know, so that's the difference. But, you know, I think it has potential. Ultimately, I'm interested in a much bigger delivery of this idea. And that's kind of why I'm sort of looking at India as maybe the place that could get executed, because it wouldn't be that difficult to get 100 million people there because there's no other insurance. So I went to India just before the lockdown to sort of look to see whether that could happen. And I was invited out there by a company that had 6 million members. So once COVID settles, we'll see if that's possible. But I'm very much committed to cost sharing as a way of really working out risk stratification in big populations.
One last question. Do you think there's going to be any non-religious exemptions from the Affordable Care Act? That is the caveat. I too have Liberty Health Share, and that's the caveat, is it's a religious exemption. So they're not paying for termination or contraception. And if you're an alcoholic, then yeah. So there are some downsides to the...
Well, look, also things are coming around. So, like, look, women and a generation to get, you know, basic female reproductive stuff covered by insurance. So it's like a big deal. They don't cover it because they're Christian. But there are, like, innovations, like right now for $15 a month, you can get access to contraception in the market, because, you know, a lot of companies are starting to get drugs and create packages of drugs and doctors and making them available for low cost direct to consumer. And so there's a sort of a movement where all of the stuff that's inside the package, you know, that's kind of really part of the scam. And so being able to, like, delineate all the stuff you want and choose and just get it on, you know, get it on a subscription can actually fill in some of those holes. It's not ideal, you know, and we'll see what happens with the Affordable Care Act and the election and, you know, see which direction it goes. But in general, medical cost sharing is an improvement over insurance because of the behavior that it elicits in the members.
The Community Cure, Transforming Health Outcomes Together by James Maskell is the name of the book that we've been discussing. James, where can people find you online?
So yeah, you can find, if you're a health professional, The Evolution of Medicine is my company. It's goevomed.com. We have a ton of solutions for helping doctors implement group visits, shift to functional medicine, whatever you want to do on that end. The Community Cure is a place where you can go and, you know, get more resources towards the Community Cure. And yeah, I'd be happy to connect on Instagram. I'm Mr. James Maskell, and that's where I'm sort of sharing my views on what's going on in the world. But yeah, I'm excited to see what's happening. Things are definitely, like, interestingly moving in this direction. And it's a fun time to be alive.
Well, thank you so much. I very much appreciate you and everything you're doing. Thank you, James.
Thanks, Chris.